From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now. Happy New Year. The Islamic State claimed responsibility today for the New Year's morning attack at the Reyna nightclub in Istanbul that killed 39 people and wounded dozens more. Funerals are being held for the victims, and the manhunt for the gunman continues. Turkish officials said today that they have his fingerprints and a basic description. The BBC's Selin Giret joins us now from Istanbul. And Selin, tell us more about ISIS claiming responsibility for this attack. How did they make it? What did they say?
The so-called Islamic State said they carried out the attack in Turkey, which is a rare statement, because up until now, every attack that was thought to be carried out by the IS was blamed on them by Turkish officials. It is indeed the very first time the IS have said they carried out an attack in Turkish territory. That might be a game changer. Game changer meaning more attacks coming from IS ranks could follow that would take place in Turkey. In fact, in their statement, they said this was a response to the increasing Turkish military involvement in Syria. Turkey had been engaging in airstrikes and it had been engaging in ground operations in the town of El Bab and hitting IS ranks more and more since September. So what has happened at the Reyna nightclub, it seems, was a retaliation for Turkish strikes against the IS. And the IS says Turkey could embrace itself for more.
Now, we have seen surveillance video of the attack as the shooter approaches the nightclub. Is there any more information about who this could be and about just how intense this manhunt is?
The latest picture of the gunman has emerged. It's all over Turkish media as we speak. We don't yet know the identity of the gunman or the nationality. He could be a Turkish citizen. He could be a foreign national. We don't yet know. But the Prime Minister, Binali Yildirim, said they are getting close to identifying who the gunman was. The manhunt is still on, and more details emerged today about what happened on the night of the attack. It appears the gunman took a taxi to the nightclub and his weapon, his long-barreled weapon, was inside the boot of the car, the taxi, and he took his weapon out, he took his rifle out and rushed towards the doors of the club, shot two people, one of whom was a security guard, rushed his way in and turned the whole place into a scene of a massacre, firing up to 180 bullets to the crowd. And within 7 minutes, he just got his coat off, changed his outlook and walked out, taking advantage of the chaos that he himself created. He is still at large. There is a massive manhunt, and police are trying to locate where he is.
And the police believe that it is just one person at this point?
Initially, there were eyewitnesses who suggested that there were more than one attackers. Some talked about two, some talked about three. But the officials and the police sources are saying that there was one man, one gunman involved in the attack that happened in Istanbul.
Well, this, of course, just the latest in what was an absolutely terrible year for Turkey. I mean, just last month, the Russian ambassador to Turkey assassinated in Ankara. Kurdish separatists are to blame for a stadium bombing last month as well. Of course, there was the coup attempt earlier this year that left several hundred people dead. What is the feeling there about whether the government is doing anything to make people feel secure?
Well, Turkey has already gone through a very, very difficult year, as you have summarized. In the last 18 months, more than 500 people have lost their lives only in terror attacks in this country, coming from either the so-called IS, Islamic State, or Kurdish militant groups or leftist militant groups. The government says they are doing everything in their power to stop these terror attacks. But the Prime Minister, for instance, said no nation is immune to such attacks, reminding other attacks that have taken place in Europe, for instance. instance. But Istanbul, just 3 weeks ago, witnessed another attack. And for instance, one person, one man called Fatih Çakmak in his 30s, who survived that particular attack in Istanbul 3 weeks ago, which targeted policemen at the football, one of the biggest football stadiums in Istanbul. He got killed in the attack at Reyna nightclub. So within 3 weeks, he survived one attack, he got killed in the other. This Wow. feels like a vicious circle for Turkey, and people are increasingly feel insecure.
Exactly. What does that mean for the people who live in this country that seems to be getting torn apart?
The people just want to live in peace. They want an end to the almost daily routine of terror and the atmosphere of fear taking place in this country. There have been over almost 30 attacks in the last year. There are operations. Everyone is feeling increasingly concerned about what might happen next, especially considering that the Islamic State is increasing their threats against Turkey. Will there be a spillover of the Syrian war more and more in Turkey? Will Turkey become more vulnerable? Will people be able to go about their lives safely day to day, just mind about their own businesses and lead a peaceful life? That is what they want. And they want the government to maintain their security, to maintain peace in this country. And that's what the government vows to deliver.
The BBC's Selin Garrett in Istanbul. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Ireland is a well-known destination for multinational companies looking for favorable tax laws. More than 700 U.S. corporations have a presence there, including Facebook and Google. But Ireland has a growing startup scene of its own, and one that's starting to attract American investors, especially from farming states. St. Louis Public Radio's Maria Altman recently traveled to Ireland with an ag delegation from St. Louis to get a look.
At Ireland's National Plowing Championships, watching farmers skillfully till the earth is the heart of the event. But the more than 280,000 visitors who attend Europe's largest ag showcase each fall also are on the lookout for what's new in agriculture, from vendors in hundreds of white tents outside Tullamore, Ireland. In this tent, the founders of the startup Mucol explain their product. CEO Emmett Savage describes it as a mobile phone for a cow's tail.
What the device does is it measures contractions in the onset of labor in a pregnant cow. We use those contractions and the tail movements associated with those contractions to accurately predict when a cow is going to calf. And based on that information, we send a text message to the farmer to notify him the calving is about 1 hour away.
That means farmers can go to bed knowing they'll be alerted if one of their cows goes into labor. But Mucol is getting interest from far outside Ireland's farming community. The startup recently signed a multi-million dollar distribution agreement with Animal Health International, a veterinary and farm supply company headquartered in Colorado.
That's a huge deal for us. We're really excited about partnering with these guys. They're such a massive outfit, and I think they're going to be very instrumental in rolling Mucol out in the U.S.
Mucol and lots of other Irish startups are getting investment and access to global markets with help from Ireland's government. The agency Enterprise Ireland has offices in more than 30 foreign countries and invests in about 250 startups a year.
We are the third largest funder of startups globally in terms of volume of deals.
Enterprise Ireland CEO Julie Cinnamon says with a population of 4.5 million people, Ireland has to think in terms of exports. But she says attracting foreign interest requires real innovation.
And I often say, people don't buy products from Ireland because we're nice people. We are nice people, but they buy them because they solve problems and they actually really do something different.
Enterprise Ireland put that innovation on display with a startup pitch competition at the National Ploughing Championships.
What's going to happen this morning is that we are going to have the pitches from six companies.
The judges included Brian Clevenger, an American investor who's visiting the championships for the first time.
I've never seen anything even remotely like this.
Clevenger is a managing director of the Yield Lab, a St. Louis-based accelerator that provides $100,000 investments each to about six companies a year, along with mentorship.
We looked around at a variety of different places to have a European footprint. And I got to tell you, Ireland blew us away with how aggressively and how clearly they wanted us to be here in Ireland.
While the Yield Lab is looking for a European foothold in Ireland, other groups are hoping Irish startups will expand into the U.S. The nonprofit BioSTL spent the last 2 years on an initiative to get bioscience startups from Israel to put a presence in St. Louis. But Executive Director Don Rubin says recently, Ireland grabbed their attention.
It turns out that Ireland is jam-packed with innovation. And we have, for the last several months, been working with Ireland to identify companies that could benefit from being in St. Louis.
Mucol, the company that just made the deal with the American Animal Health Company, already has a distribution center in Kansas. CEO Emmett Savage says he expects they'll open offices in the U.S., Europe, and elsewhere. But Mucol's headquarters, he says, will remain here in Ireland. For Here and Now, I'm Maria Altman.
2017 marks the 75th anniversary of a landmark study on American poverty. Let Us Now Praise Famous Men is a book produced by writer James Agee and the legendary photographer Walker Evans, who moved in with Alabama sharecroppers during the Great Depression to better understand what the farmers' lives were like. In the 1980s, journalist Dale Maharage and photographer Michael Williamson revisited some of those families for their own book that was called And Their Children After Them. It won a Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction. And then in 2016, Maharage took yet another look at the lives of the working poor. His story is in Smithsonian Magazine. Dale Maharage, welcome back to Here and Now.
Great to be back.
Your article was based on the book, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men. It was published in 1941. Remind us, what did that book achieve?
James Agee, a writer for Fortune magazine and a photographer Walker Evans, went to Alabama to document what then were the poorest working people in America. It was an assignment for the magazine, and they spent about a month and a half down there with three sharecropping families. Extremely destitute. They wore, you know, raggy clothing, picked cotton by hand, plowed with mules. He came back to write his story for Fortune. The magazine rejected it. So like many writers do, he said, I'm going to do a book. And he did this book called Let Us Not Praise Famous Men that came out in 1941.
Well, the photos are so iconic. I'm looking at some of them right now. They're black and white, of course. Families on their porch steps, in their bedrooms. You know, the houses are ramshackle. They're wearing these tattered clothes. I feel like I'm brought back instantly to my high school history books. But the book that Agee wrote didn't really catch on right away, did it?
No, it was very lyrical and very odd. It was really the first of what we call new journalism today, where it was very experiential. So it pretty much died. And then he did a book called Death in the Family. He died. It was published posthumously, and it won a Pulitzer Prize. Concurrent with that, there was an interest in American poverty in the 60s. So the book was rediscovered, and it blew up and became a sensation in the 1960s. That was the backstory on you know, it usually happens that way with artists, unfortunately.
Hmm. So fast forward to the 80s then, and you get an assignment to go out and meet some of the people who were featured in this work, or at least their family members. What did you find?
Well, I went to Alabama for the first time in 1985 and to trace these families. There was 22 original family members. And what we found was they were working not in cotton anymore. Cotton was dead. They were doing riverboat jobs, textile mills, and such. Very bottom of the economic ladder. Some of them, you know, had struggled up to just barely make it.
So their lives hadn't changed, really.
Not really. But the sad thing is I was back there last December. It's been kind of an ongoing project. I keep going down there, and I met one of the family members, the daughter of one of the people. And those jobs are gone, Peter. The textile mills closed. The jobs were shipped away. They were automated. And pretty much the desperation, they're not living in shacks and riding mules now, but the poverty level is just stunning.
Well, we all know, based on this past election, that this sort of thing is still so relevant today. So again, you go out this time recently, you and photographer Matt Black, you go to California's Central Valley, you go to Cleveland, and you go to Northern Maine. I want to ask you to spend a little time talking about this 51-year-old farm worker that you met in California. Her name is Martha, and she lived in this little community called The Scissors, which, you know, straight out of a Steinbeck novel. What did you learn there?
Oh, my gosh. Well, in Spanish, it's called La Tijera. And when she told me it was The Scissors, it's two roads that come together at a sharp angle, and she's right between the blades. She was working in a water, going to have a job in a watermelon packing plant for $10 and something an hour. They were 3 months behind on their rent. They lived in a horrible, horrible little house, very, very decrepit place. And they're undocumented. And so her chance of getting a real good job is pretty slim to none. And these are the people who pick our food, process our food. I'm not a stranger to the Central Valley. I reported here in Sacramento for many years, and I did a lot of farm worker stories. And it's always amazed me how the people who provide our food are sometimes the most undernourished and most desperate.
You point out in the piece that the poverty rate in this country, $12,000 for a single person a year, $24,000 for a household of four. But writing about this is sort of a minefield for journalists, isn't it?
Well, it is, because use what they call poverty porn. I could have done this piece and just said, "Wow, here's a bunch of poor people," and just presented them. And it's not really that good. I wanted to take it another step with this project when I got the assignment from Smithsonian. I wanted to look at some of the things that are being done, very innovative, on the ground right now to help these people, things that we desperately need now in this country. The main one was in Cleveland. It's the Cleveland model, it's called, the Evergreen Companies, where it was a private foundation funded this job creation program. It's three companies. There's a laundromat, there's a greenhouse, and there's a construction company. And there's about 125 people working there now. And I think of, you know, the things we could do, like this program where they get paid a very good wage. They're co-owners of the company. It's a cooperative model. And they can even buy houses through the company for like $20,000-some each and pay them off in 5 years. The workers are treated extremely well. And now that it's up and running, it's self-sufficient. There's no more public monies going into it. They're going to pay bonuses to the workers for the second time this year.
And you point out that this is actually a different way to approach poverty than we saw back in James Agee's day, or even back when you made your first trip in the 1980s when Ronald Reagan was president.
Yeah, we had – in the Great Depression, it was the federal government was the engine on helping people. In Reagan, it was the federal government that was going to be pulled away from helping people. And now, you know, what we're finding – I'm finding is foundations around the country are funding these job creation models. It's coming from the nonprofit sector, and there's also citizen models where people are creating their own cooperatives, urban farming cooperatives. There's thousands of these things, B corporations that are meant not to make profits first, but people first. There's several thousand B corporations. And so this has all happened in the last 10 years, and that's where the energy is coming from. And of course, at this point in America, we're not going to see any initiatives from the federal government to help working class people at this point.
Exactly. Do you think that those forms of assistance work, though, because there are millions of people who are living below the poverty line? Can these projects help all of them?
We need scale. We have to, and that's what Cleveland's trying to do. They're trying to get to scale. For instance, most recently, the Carrier Corporation in Indiana, very famously, was bailed out by the governor, Pence, who's still a governor, $7 million. And a lot of those jobs, we find out, are still going to Mexico. And probably in a few more years, the rest of the jobs will go to Mexico. The state just threw away $7 million. If they'd done what Cleveland did and created a few hundred jobs that will be there, that cannot move. Like in Cleveland, the laundry company does a laundry for the Cleveland Clinic. And they can triple the size of the laundry and workers the way the workload has gone. And the Cleveland Clinic is not going to move away. So will this solve all of our poverty problems? No. But if we can get 10 or 15 or 20% of the people now in poverty working for these companies, it's a great start.
And it might help the people who are working in these organizations, because you asked each of the people that you profiled in this piece a really fascinating question. You said, do you feel poor? On the surface, we would say, we would think, yes, they're very much still poor, but they don't think so.
Oh, my gosh. And no, and they know how to handle money like a lot of Americans do not. The first person I asked was a Simon Salazar. He works in a raisin packing plant in the Central Valley. And at first when I met him, he was suspicious of me. He was like, I don't think you struggle like us. It wasn't a mean question. It was more of an honest observation. So I wound up volunteering, helping them build houses for 3 days. And at one point I asked Simon, I said, do you consider yourself poor? And he rubbed his beard. And he pointed to a van and he said, see that van? It's used. I saved 2 years to buy it. I paid cash. He said, I have no debt. He says, you look at people who look like they're rich. How much debt do they have? I have no debt. He lives within his means. So I thought it was a fascinating answer. And so I decided to ask everybody else the same question on my travels.
Do you think it says something about the state of poverty in the United States today?
Well, it says something about money. A lot of the people I interviewed across the country, these are people who do not have credit cards. Many of them don't even have bank accounts, but they do not use credit because they know they can't get into debt. So they're very frugal and creative in how they survive. So I think the myth is poor people are lazy, they're stupid, they don't. No, it's quite the opposite. They're very smart with money, the ones I interviewed, and they're very astute about how to survive in America in this current economy.
Dale Maharaj's story about America's working poor, along with photos by Matt Black, is in Smithsonian Magazine. We'll link you to it at hereandnow.org. Dale, thank you very much.
Hey, great to be here.
For years, a public cemetery in Key West, Florida, has been known for a headstone with an unusually sarcastic epitaph. And it turns out there's a whole section of the cemetery with a collection of last word one-liners. Nancy Killinger from Here and Now contributor WLRN reports.
When volunteer tour guide Patty Tiffany leads tours at the Key West Cemetery, one simple gravestone gets a lot of attention.
Here we are at one of everyone's favorite places in the cemetery, and this is the very famous quote for the epitaph of B.P. Roberts. She says on it, I told you I was sick.
B.P. Roberts died almost 40 years ago, and more recently, within the last decade, one of the new mausoleums has acquired more unusual epitaphs, like these.
If you're reading this, you desperately need a hobby.
I always dreamed of owning a small place in Key West.
So long, and thanks for all the fish.
That last marker will be familiar to fans of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Another one says, Grok, look it up. If you do, you'll find that's from Stranger in a Strange Land by Robert Heinlein. And then there's the one that answers every child's burning question.
You were always my favorite. Love, Mom.
Russell Britton is the sexton who runs the Key West Cemetery. He says they didn't intentionally put all those unusual markers together. And it's just a coincidence, he says, that they are all in a section reserved for people who've been cremated.
I'm not sure why, but maybe it's because they've been cremated and they thought they want to leave their mark on history.
Britton says he hasn't heard any objections to the recent additions.
Not yet.
But there is one marker he thought might offend some people.
When I submitted the order to the bronze foundry, they called me back and they said, are you sure this is what you want on this headstone?
Jesus Christ, these people are horrible.
Those words grace the headstone of former Key West resident Giorgio Aversa. His wife Amy chose those words.
The reason why the epitaph reads like this is because we would go out socially sometimes, or we would meet people and you'd go, Jesus Christ, these people are horrible.
Amy Culver-Aversa says her husband used that phrase all the time.
Probably 20 times a day.
Tragically, Giorgio Aversa took his own life 8 years ago, but his wife wanted people to remember his humor.
And because of the tragedy of his death, I didn't want that to be the last marker. So to go and, I can't even say this, to go and visit him, I wanted to laugh.
Only a couple people have questioned Culver-Aversa about the epitaph. And she says when she explained it, they understood.
I think that has more of a tether to the heart than some one-liner that, you know, you picked out of a cemetery book.
Culver Aversa says when she visits her husband's grave, she does laugh, and that makes her want to keep coming back. For Here and Now, I'm Nancy Klingener in Key West, Florida.
And we've got more to share with you here. There's one from the Key West Cemetery that says, I'm just resting my eyes. Wishful thinking, maybe. We found another one from Greenmount Cemetery in Hammonton, New Jersey, that says, this is the only stone we've left unturned. If you've got a cemetery one-liner to share with us, funny, meaningful, or otherwise, let us know here at now.org. The Navajo Nation is in desperate need of housing. The federal government has given the country's largest Native American tribe more than $1.5 billion to help build and refurbish homes. It's part of the Native American Housing Assistance and Self-Determination Act that was passed by Congress in 1998 to address housing shortages on American Indian reservations. But a new investigation by the Arizona Republic finds that nearly two decades later, there is little to show for all that money. Joining us now is Craig Harris. He's a senior reporter at the Arizona Republic who's investigated the Navajo Housing Authority, the agency responsible for distributing the money. Craig, thanks for coming on.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Well, it is incredibly hard to find housing on the Navajo reservation. And you know, based on your reporting, I don't think it's a stretch to say that there's a housing crisis up there. Is that right?
Absolutely. There's an absolute housing crisis. Now, they talk about on their own reports, and they need tens of thousands of homes up there on the reservation. And, you know, the reservation, it encompasses Arizona, Utah, and New Mexico, and it's about the size of West Virginia, so it's a massively huge area here.
And the homes, you know, you describe this in your piece, the ones that exist have peeling baseboards, they have windows that don't shut, wall panels held up by duct tape. I mean, just tell us more about the conditions of the housing stock.
Yeah, most of the houses up on the reservation are really in pretty poor shape. That is the universal complaint among folks who live there up on the reservation. And even when a so-called renovation occurs, a lot of the residents up there, the people are just not happy because the workmanship is so shoddy, they say, that, you know, the doors don't line up. We've seen places where you have a vent that's supposed to go outside for your dryer, to your washer and dryer. It's in the wrong place, so it doesn't work, so you can't hook it up. You know, just little things that, you know, most people take for granted when they purchase a home or rent a home that just doesn't happen up on the reservation.
It's very remote as well. It's also extremely poor. The statistics are almost impossible to believe. Poverty rate of 43%. You report that 22% of Navajo adults have full-time jobs. I mean, is that part of the problem? Just, I mean, the sheer poverty there.
It's an amazing poverty. It's an extremely poor reservation. It's probably the poorest or one of the poorest in the country. And it's clearly, if it was its own state, it would be the poorest state in the union. Unemployment is rampant. You know, it's like four or five times worse than the worst state here in the country. And, you know, there's just a lot of problems up on the reservation as a whole. And it's a very, very beautiful place on one hand, but it's also very harsh. It's cold. The infrastructure is lacking. And so there are a lot of issues up there just on for people to find employment and to find good jobs.
Mm-hmm. The crazy thing is, of course, we've known this for a long time about the state of Native American, about the state of living conditions for Native Americans in this country for ages. And there is supposed to be a solution. The federal government has paid out $1.7 billion about in housing money to the Navajo Reservation since 1998. And this is really the key to your investigation. You ask a pretty basic question: what happened to the money?
Well, and that's a part of the problem. And if you look at the numbers, you know, we're only talking 25-30% of that number actually went to build homes. And even when the homes were built, there were questions about what went on. I mean, one of the worst things that we found is that the reservation built 91 homes up in a place called Shiprock, New Mexico. And through a myriad of problems of almost too numerous to count, at the end of the day, they tore 90 of them down. And it's just sad. And so people live in these just box, you know, homes that are crowded, that where there's they're dilapidated. And then they built these homes and then they tore them down. Or they have shelters in different parts of the state that just sit for years. Or they build other homes that they build and then no one occupies them. So it's just almost a sad comedy of errors in a place where so much housing is needed, and then when they do build them, they make just massive mistakes.
And in some cases, they're not even spending the money. You write that $250 million is just sitting in the tribe's federal account dedicated to this program. So question would be, is it incompetence? Is it corruption? Is it both? What's going on?
Well, I don't quite know if I can answer on that part. I mean, there have been questions about, you know, how well they're managing the money. You know, they will argue now that they have spent the money down, but they won't give a detailed breakdown. I mean, that surplus actually got up to $500 million at one point a few years ago. And you have to question, okay, well, where does it go? And they kind of give a general area of where it goes, but you can't get a detailed breakdown because they're sovereign. You know, one year they spent, you know, tens of millions of dollars just on overhead administration, and they didn't build a single home. So it's, you know, it is really questionable about what's going on, why homes aren't being built, what the problem is, and it's just a constant struggle.
What about accountability for this Navajo Housing Authority? This is no secret. The federal government knows this has been going on. What are they doing about it?
Well, the feds have stepped in recently, and they want $96 million back because they're saying back around 2012, the tribe – or not the tribe, the Navajo Housing Authority said it was going to build all these homes, and they didn't. And so HUD, you know, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, says we want that money back, and the tribe says no, we're not letting you have that money back. And so now they're in court. So they could – the federal government actually could take about $96 million back from the Navajo Housing Authority.
And maybe give it back to other tribes who would find a use for it.
They would. That would be the point. They wouldn't just take it back and be punitive. It would be punitive against the Navajo tribe, but the money would actually be distributed to other tribes throughout the country who could use it in a better way.
This is heartbreaking because we're talking about people's homes, right? It's like the fundamental thing that you have in your life. And you spoke to a woman named Carletta Begay, who lives in Shiprock, New Mexico, on the reservation. And my takeaway from the reporting on this was that this was like an American dream for her. She was thrilled at this idea of having a driveway with a curb, with a garage, you know, like simple things that so many people take for granted. And so we're talking about this actually impacting a lot of people.
Well, yeah, and it is. You know, we spent a couple days with Carletta, and, you know, she's a very sweet lady, very simple lady. Husband's a truck driver, and, you know, she and her four daughters live in a, you know, 600, 700 square foot home. And she did have a dream. She had a dream that this home would be hers, that she would actually have a garage, that she would actually have curb cuts, that they would actually put street signs on these streets, which, you know, for most Americans, we take all that for granted. But for her, that was part of the American dream. And then at the end of the day, they just tore the houses down. And it was very sad. And, you know, she's still up there in Shiprock. It's a very remote part of the country. And those homes would have made a tremendous difference for her and for, you know, 90-some other families living up there who could really have used a nice home. And we're not talking extravagant home. These were 1,300, 1,200 square foot homes that were modest, but they had things that we take for granted, a garage, you know, modern appliances. And it would have been wonderful if she could have had something like that.
Craig Harris, senior reporter at the Arizona Republic, reported this story along with his colleague Dennis Wagner. Craig, thanks very much.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on, and thank you for giving us the time.
We've also been following the protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline for a few months now, and there is an update to that story. Police arrested three people after opponents of the pipeline hung a banner from the roof of the U.S. Bank Stadium in Minneapolis yesterday during the Minnesota Vikings football game. Two protesters climbed over a guardrail and rappelled down from a truss in the roof. They unfurled a banner urging U.S. Bank to divest its support for the pipeline. The Dakota Access Pipeline would carry oil Trail from North Dakota to Illinois. It's almost complete, but opponents have protested a proposed section of that project near the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota. Members of the tribe say it will endanger their water supply. Well, in December, the Environmental Protection Agency denied a permit for a section of the pipeline that would cross the Missouri River. The president-elect Donald Trump says he supports finishing the project. In just about 2.5 weeks, Donald Trump will be sworn in as the 45th president of the United States. And that means just 2.5 weeks left of the Obama administration. It will be a great relief for many Trump supporters. But in the time that he's got left, President Obama has an eye on his legacy. And he's trying to prevent Donald Trump from undoing his key achievements. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic, and he joins us now, as he does each Monday, from New York City. Hey, Derek.
Hello there.
So President Obama sent out a New Year's tweet yesterday, Derek, and it said, "It has been the privilege of my life to serve you as your president. I look forward to standing with you as a citizen." I read that, and I think, geez, it must be really surreal for any president to say goodbye to such an office.
Yeah, this statement sounds completely normal to me, but the moment is extremely weird. The big story here to me is that President Obama had a very clear plan to cement his legacy, and that plan's name was Hillary Clinton, and she lost the election. And so this is Plan B, to use executive orders and last-minute civil service appointments to lock in as much of his agenda as possible, knowing full well that the next president, Donald Trump, is armed with a clear Republican majority in the House and Senate, with an opening to essentially obliterate the last 8 years of public policy. And more than an opening, actually, Republicans have essentially said in no uncertain terms, we are poised to undo the last 8 years.
Yeah, they're ready to do it. It's also interesting that Obama uses Twitter on New Year's Day to list through his achievements, much in the way Donald Trump might. Achievements in fuel efficiency, health care, job growth. What else is the president looking at right now? You say Republicans are trying to cut back what he's done. What is the president most afraid of?
So think about what Obama's legacy would have been with a Hillary Clinton presidency. The Affordable Care Act, Dodd-Frank financial reform, a step towards environmental protections, as you noted. The president did more to combat income inequality than any White House, perhaps since the Johnson administration. But congressional Republicans and the president-elect have explicitly said they want to undo basically all of this. They want to repeal Obamacare. They want to repeal Dodd-Frank. They want to roll back environmental regulations. They want to cut taxes for the rich and cut spending on health care for the low income. It amounts essentially, I think, to a kind of historical erasure. We haven't seen this in a long time, an administration that wants to fundamentally and rather radically undo that which was, at least for liberals, a rather radical and successful 8 years.
Well, and look, Donald Trump won the election, so by extension, voters have made this statement as well. But what does it mean for a president to have his landmark achievement basically dismantled, so that's the plan for Republicans, so quickly after he leaves office?
Right. So here's an example of how Obama's efforts to protect his legacy could be so easily undone. There's a relatively new rule out from the Department of Health and Human Services on Planned Parenthood. It says essentially that the states cannot deny Medicaid funding to Planned Parenthood. Donald Trump's pick for the secretary of this department, Health and Human Services, is a man named Tom Price. Tom Price wants to undo Obamacare. He wants to cut Medicaid spending, and he wants to defund Planned Parenthood. Congress has voted along these lines several times. So what's going to happen? Well, Congress can just vote the same way they voted several times before to defund Planned Parenthood. But rather than have somebody sitting in the Oval Office waiting to veto the bill in Barack Obama, they have a president who might be prepared to sign on the dotted line. And so this is why it's interesting, in a weird way, that President Obama's best chance to save part of his legacy isn't going to be congressional Republicans who disagree with it sort of point for point and item for item. It might be President-elect, future President Donald Trump, who may depart with congressional Republican orthodoxy on issues like Planned Parenthood or on issues like Medicaid funding or income support for the low income. So it's going to be very interesting to see the relationship between congressional Republicans and Donald Trump and whether he essentially acts as a rubber stamp camp for an agenda they've been trying to build for the last 8
years.
Yeah,
and as you say, Obama is just acting on his own in these last couple of weeks. He's issued sanctions against Russia for the alleged hacking of the Democratic Committee last year. Also has made some banned some drilling in the Arctic and Atlantic oceans. Let's look at some precedent for that. What is it normally like this as we get ready to transition into presidents, or is this somehow unique?
This is pretty unique. You know, Bush, President George W. Bush and Barack Obama worked together to combat the financial collapse and stave off a Great Depression. The biggest scandal when Bill Clinton left office was that he was pardoning too many people, the so-called pardon gate. What you have now is an incredibly well-organized among Republicans, an incredibly well-organized effort to undo the last 8 years. As Dave Weigel has reported in The Washington Post today, they have several arrows in their quiver, several ways to essentially undo not just law, laws which can be, you know, voted to be overturned, but also lots of regulations that can also be voted to be overturned. So I do think that you see, to a relatively unprecedented extent, at least in modern times, an incoming administration armed with a very clear majority in the House and Senate who are prepared to essentially, you know, erase the last decade of advancements among Democrats.
Yeah. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd. Happy New Year.